You're listening to Clinical Conversations. I'm Joe Elia. Our guest this time is David Bradford, co-author of a study in Health Affairs on medical marijuana, showing lower prescription medication use in states that have legalized medical marijuana. His co-author is Ashley Bradford. And the Bradfords together studied Medicare Part D records on prescribing practices. When they focused on conditions like pain and sleep disorders, which marijuana is thought to alleviate, they found that prescriptions for traditional FDA-approved prescription drugs for those conditions dropped significantly in states that had legalized medical marijuana use. In states where medical marijuana was not legal, there was no relative change. David Bradford holds the Busby Chair in Public Policy at the University of Georgia. Welcome to Clinical Conversations, David.
Thanks very much for having me.
I just gave an oversimplified summary of your research, and I hope you'll forgive that. Let's take a closer look. You examined the Medicare Part D data, which is the prescription drug benefit in Medicare, from across the country for what period?
So we had data from Medicare Part D, and in fact, we had data on all prescriptions that were filled in Medicare Part D from 2010 to 2013, inclusive of that time, as you say, across all states.
And you examined, staying with states for a moment, there are roughly half the states, somewhat less than that, have legalized medical marijuana use. Is that right?
Well, actually, as of today, exactly half of them have. 25 states have approved medical marijuana use in the sense that most people would recognize the term. That, you know, many other states have approved very limited use of THC oil. But half the states, Pennsylvania and Ohio, just came on board, just approved their laws within the last 2 months. At the time that we were doing our study, although the study itself was completed recently, the data ended in 2013. And in 2013, there were 17 states plus the District of Columbia that had implemented and had effective medical marijuana laws in place.
You then examined 9 conditions for which medical marijuana use was thought to have a benefit. Did all of those conditions show a lowered prescription drug use after implementation of medical marijuana laws?
No, all of them didn't. You know, we picked 9. excuse me. That the reason we selected those 9 is that was an intersection of conditions from which states had approved, that states had listed as approved reasons for getting medical marijuana, and also an intersection of disease areas where there's clinical evidence in the sort of the meta-analyses that exist over all of the studies, where there's clinical evidence that there might be some benefit. So we chose those 9 carefully. One of them we actually did not expect to find a substitution effect. For glaucoma, we actually expected to find that prescription drugs would go up. And the reason for that is that glaucoma is listed in nearly all of the states as a reason for using medical marijuana. And it's one of the most commonly searched for terms with marijuana on Google. But it turns out that the clinical evidence for glaucoma says that there's a large effect, about a 25% reduction in intraocular pressure, but the effect lasts only about an hour. And so clinicians would not be able to let a patient who was newly diagnosed with glaucoma leave without a traditional treatment. It has profound implications, that condition on blindness and pain and things of that sort. And so what we expected was the publicity surrounding approving medical marijuana with glaucoma would draw new patients into the doctor. Those patients would then get treated with traditional medicines, and we'd see an uptick in that. We did see a slight positive increase, but it wasn't statistically significant. The other condition where we didn't see statistical significance, where again it's very commonly thought to be marijuana thought to be beneficial, was spasticity. And the reason for that was just there were so many fewer drugs prescribed for spasticity in the Part D data that there just wasn't enough power to actually detect a significant effect. For the other 7 conditions, very large substitutions away from those drugs that were large in magnitude as far as just, you know, the number, and large in the sense of very significant statistically.
As your introduction says, you were looking for evidence that, in fact, medical marijuana was being used clinically. I mean, because there has been not much evidence either way about it.
It was surprising to my co-author and I. Actually, this is the third study that we've done on medical marijuana. And you know, I'm an economist by training. She's a sociologist. And so our first approach was to do the common thing that's been done in the literature, which is to ask, what spillover effects are there from medical marijuana? Our first study was, why do states adopt it? And then the second study was, well, what are the spillovers on young people in high school? And then we were sitting around at lunch talking about that paper as we're writing it up and wondered about how it's used clinically. She went out, being the junior author, and did the literature search, and we realized that nobody had asked what we think is a very obvious question, which is, well, is medical marijuana, is there any evidence it's being used as medicine? It seemed to us obvious. Nobody had answered the question, so we were pleased to be the first to do it.
And there were financial implications as well. For instance, between 2010 and 2013, you estimated that over $500 million within that time frame was saved nationally by those states that had implemented medical marijuana uses. Is that right?
That's right. And that, of course, was increasing over time as states turned on effective medical marijuana policies. In 2010, I believe, I don't recall the exact number as I sit here, but I believe it was something like 12 states had medical marijuana in place. By 2013, it was 17 plus D.C., and, for example, in 2013, we estimated that about $165 million less was spent in Medicare Part D just from those states and just those seven conditions where we found an effect. And even just for those conditions, if you were to extrapolate that to the country and assume counterfactually that all the states had adopted an MML, then we would estimate that the savings would have been about $470 million, nearly half a billion dollars, which is about half a percent, would have been half a percent of Medicare Part D spending. So it's not a gigantic number in the world of Washington, you know, federal programs, but, you know, half a billion dollars is a significant amount of money in a world of scarce resources that could be allocated to other uses.
And the evidence that you, it's fair to characterize this evidence that you've collected as indirect evidence.
That's correct. So to my knowledge, the ideal data set that we'd like to have to study this question doesn't exist. What we'd really like is a data set of patients with their, you know, their characteristics as far as their education and their age and their health state and their utilization of drugs and other healthcare services and their use of marijuana. That's really what we need to get our arms completely around this question. That data doesn't exist. And so we're providing, you know, right now, I think for the foreseeable future at least, researchers like myself are going to need to look at these indirect evidence. But we feel that our study design, which compared changes within states that have adopted, that turned on a medical marijuana law, to changes in states that never had it, helps us to get to eliminate the potential that all we're picking up is some unobserved characteristic of the states that adopt MMLs that makes them different, right? So we don't think that our study design, we think that our study design rules that out. And we also picked four clinical areas where there's just no evidence that marijuana matters. And we ran our model on that and we never saw any effect. And so we feel pretty good that we've got a causal effect here, but we absolutely need to take a look at this from a lot of different angles.
Yeah, so let's go back to that point where, as a control, you looked at say drugs for infection, drugs to control bleeding, for instance, for which marijuana has no known effect, and you found that spending changes or prescription changes within states, comparing the two groups of states, those with and those without medical marijuana laws, they did not change over that period.
That's right, and so this is what we call a falsification test, right? So we've for our primary categories where we think that there should be an effect, we see big effects, and we always see big effects no matter how we specify the model. but we want to make sure that it's not just something else going on. So we went and did a falsification test. Here's four areas where, as you say, the anti-infectives, the antivirals, the phosphorus stimulants, and the blood bleeding disorder drugs. There shouldn't be an effect, and no matter how we specify the models, we never saw it. So it helps us have confidence in our results.
At the end of your article, you write that lowered costs, the benefit that you point out, are, quote, not a sufficient justification, end quote, to legalize medical marijuana. And that's a decision, the legalization is a decision that you call complex and multi-dimensional. But the people making those decisions are certainly going to be using data like yours to...
Well, we hope so. I mean, you know, one of the things that we don't want people to interpret our results as advocating is to say, oh, we can save a lot of money if we just implement medical marijuana. There's a lot of ways you can save money that would not be helpful for society. We could save money if we eliminated Medicare Part D, but that's obviously not a policy approach anybody wants to contemplate. So we don't want to put this forward, this potential savings, as the reason to do this, for two reasons. One is that it's a complicated decision, as we said. Secondly, of course, we're not saying that society is saving, you know, saved in 2013 $165 million, because, of course, if people were substituting to marijuana, as the evidence suggests, they, of course, were having to buy the marijuana themselves. So it's not as if how much less we spent, we just don't know. But it is, in fact, a way of helping manage tight budgets. So the main take-home, we think, from this is that this is yet additional evidence that people are reacting to medical marijuana when it's available as a treatment option as if it's medicine. Right? And the primary point, we think, for the current debate is that marijuana's current status as a Schedule I drug under the Controlled Substances Act of 1972 is a definition that requires that the product have that has a high potential for abuse and no clinical benefit. And we're saying, look, physicians and patients together are acting as if there's clinical benefit. And this is another piece of evidence that second category, on its face, can't be defended any longer. And I think, I mean, we would argue that the DEA, who's currently has the authority, or the Attorney General with the ultimate authority under the Controlled Substances Act, should seriously consider rescheduling the product so that we can get the evidence we need. What we really need are rigorously conducted placebo double-blinded trials to find out with standardized dosing what the benefits of this product are, so that we can, in fact, use it or not use it as a body of evidence would indicate. But it's too hard to conduct the studies at this point.
How have your colleagues reacted to your findings? Have there been any criticisms of your approach?
You know, it's funny. It only came out Wednesday, and we're talking on Friday. So there hasn't been a lot of time for academic response to it. I will say that a couple of the newspapers that have written articles have, in fact, shown it to experts, which is a common thing, shown it to other people, and they've been complimentary of it. And you know, they have pointed out things that we point out, which is, you know, we can't say that people are using more marijuana because we don't see that it is indirect evidence. So to this point, people have responded positively. And, you know, mostly academics try very hard not to be partisan about this. And, you know, our goal and what we wish to accomplish is to provide evidence for policymakers to use, and really try not to take a position, a partisan position on either side. So I really don't expect much negative in that sense from my academic colleagues. Hopefully what they'll do is they'll see that they can do it better, and they'll do another study themselves, and we'll get more evidence.
I want to thank you, David Bradford, for talking with us today, and wish you luck on future endeavors in this regard. Can you disclose any research that you're undertaking now?
Sure. We actually have two projects related to this that we're working on, one of which I think was just submitted to a journal yesterday that shows using county-level drug poisonings, the large majority of which are opiate deaths, showing that when states adopt medical marijuana laws that emphasize dispensaries, that we actually are seeing significant reduction in opioid deaths in counties that are in those states once the dispensary laws come into place. So we're seeing a beneficial effect there. And my co-author, Ashley, and I are replicating this study that we've been talking about today using Medicaid data, and we're seeing very similar results in the younger Medicaid population that we found in this Medicare population as well.
Well, good luck, and I hope maybe we'll be able to talk about these things again.
I hope so. Thanks for inviting me.
That was the 204th Clinical Conversation. The others are available free at podcasts.jwatch.org. My executive producer is Kristen Kelly, and we come to you through the NEJM Group. Thank you for listening.